قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: أصدقاؤك ثلاثة وأعداؤك ثلاثة، فأصدقاؤك صديقك وصديق صديقك وعدو عدوك، وأعداؤك عدوك وعدو صديقك وصديق عدوك.
Imam Ali stated, "Your friends are three and your enemies are three. Your friends are your friend, your friend's friend, and your enemy's enemy. And your enemies are your enemy, your friend's enemy, and your enemy's friend." Dear friends, it's a blessing to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Dear friends, we find that in the universal persona of this first divinely appointed Imam, this Imam who was selected and chosen by the Almighty Allah, and of course who can be said to be the living miracle of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, we find that his persona is truly beyond time and space. I do not know of any other personality such as the persona and the personality of Imam Ali that has been able to last well over 1,000 years, and that too to have so much knowledge and wisdom from this individual. And of course, it's not just knowledge and wisdom and statements that have been related or are hearsay. These are documented things, which of course cannot be said about many of the other individuals that time has seen. Now, one of the interesting things that we see the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, of course, is the concept of ad-du'a, of supplication, of speaking and having a conversation with the Almighty Allah. Now, these conversations sometimes are for when we want to request something from Allah. Sometimes these conversations are when we need help from Allah. Now, in one instance, when talking about our prayers not being rejected, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam says that there are three groups of people whose prayers are never rejected. One of those three groups whose prayers are never rejected is a benefactor's son who treats his father fairly. Now here, when we are talking about a benefactor's son, we're talking about a son who is supporting the father. So for example, the father becomes old and the son financially supports him. Perhaps the son keeps the father in his house, you know. And in this situation, because it seems like the older we get, we have this strange tendency to become a little bit hard-hearted. Our hearts become hard, we perhaps criticize our parents more, and we talk back to our parents, or we are frustrated or angered or annoyed by our parents. Of course, all of these things, which are not only negative in nature, but they are considered to be a sin. We find in the Holy Quran that Allah has told human beings to be kind, to show ahsan, goodness, mercy, kindness to our parents. Now, here we see the importance of treating our parents fairly, of treating our parents with justice, with honor, with humility, and with mercy. Now, sure, when we are young, perhaps it's easy to be kind and respectful to our parents because, you know, we live under their house, we live under their shade. And so, you know, it's that idea of my house, my rules. But when our parents become old and they no longer live in their own house, and perhaps they are no longer independent as they used to be, at that point, we might start to act inappropriately with our parents. And it is precisely at this time that Imam Ali alayhi salam says we should treat our parents fairly, to the extent that if we do this, we will be from among those whose prayers are never rejected. Of course, keeping in mind that those prayers have to be in our best interests. Another profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب سليم.
O Allah, I ask you for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعض الظالم على يدي يقول يا ليتني اتخذت مع الرسول سبيلا.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, "Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger."
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
His name brings about a sense of strength in the heart. His remembrance is a source of inspiration for the souls. His legacy is widespread throughout the centuries and around the world. No doubt, he has a special place in our hearts. And every time we speak about him, there is that attachment to his legacy and his life. No doubt that comes from his association with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and Allah has placed his love in the hearts of mankind. When you and I examine the world today, and when we come to the conclusion that one of the key facets of how human beings live today is to exceed and to be given the title of people who have achieved more than others, meaning people want to be the first in competitions. They want to attain first position in tournaments. They want to gain the most likes on a social media site. They want to be praised the most. It is all about the human being's intrinsic nature to be the best. Who is the best individual after Rasulullah? I tell you, tell me of a man who was other than Ali, who was born inside the house of Allah. Other than the commander of the faithful, who was raised so closely by the messenger of Allah. Other than Ali ibn Abi Talib, who slept in the bed of the Prophet sacrificing his life. Other than the first Imam, as the man who married his beloved daughter Sayyidatul Nisa, and no other would be a match for her. Tell me any other than the commander of the faithful to be an individual who was so courageous in the battlefield after the Holy Prophet. Tell me of another human being who stood on the shoulders of the Prophet with him to destroy the idols inside the Kaaba. Who else other than Ali was given the title of being the brother of Rasulullah both in Mecca and in Medina? Who else other than the Amir al-Mu'mineen was told the truth is with him and he is with the truth? Who is other than Ali who was told by the Prophet, I fought for the revelation of the Quran. You will fight, you will protect the interpretation, the ta'wil of the Holy Quran.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
NATO, or the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, was established in 1949 to organize political and military support between the United States and a group of European nations in order to deter and, if necessary, defeat the Soviet Union. After the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the collapse of the Soviet Union, NATO gradually morphed into an instrument through which the capitalist class of North America and Europe seeks to impose its political will on the rest of the world, mostly via military operations.
I've come here to express the United States' steadfast commitment to that alliance, which has been the cornerstone of peace, prosperity, stability for the transatlantic community for more than 70 years.
Over the past decades, the organization has waged wars on a number of countries, all in the name of democracy and peace, most of them both illegal and unsuccessful. Libya and the 2011 NATO intervention there have become synonymous with failure and disaster. The intervention didn't produce anything resembling a stable democracy. Instead, it led to utter chaos, violence, instability, and civil war.
I cannot be sure there have been no civilian casualties. What I can be sure of is that we are very, very precise and discriminate in our targeting. There have been more instances than I can think of in the conduct of this campaign where our pilots have made the correct decision to not attack a legitimate military target for concern of the civilian casualties that attack would have caused. It is a very, very high priority, and I cannot emphasize enough the precision with which we conduct these strikes.
While political entities in the West were quick to celebrate the intervention in Libya as a success, the NATO campaign caused many civilian deaths and destroyed the nation's infrastructure. Moreover, the following instability unleashed an array of militias and terrorist groups that put the whole region in danger. As for Libya, NATO has failed in yet another sense. Tensions between Turkey and France, as two state members of NATO, over supporting different sides in Libya is a case in point.
In Libya, we are supporting the legitimate government, and the French government is supporting an illegitimate warlord. And jeopardizing, as I said, NATO security, Mediterranean security, North African security, Libya's political stability. And I'm giving all this. They still blame us. They still criticize us.
Meanwhile, France considers Turkey as a non-conformist member of NATO. But Libya is not the only debacle in the recent history of NATO. After an easy military campaign in 2001 that drove the Taliban from power, ensuring stability and rebuilding Afghanistan's political and economic foundation proved challenging tasks for the transatlantic community. Despite having tens of thousands of soldiers from member countries of NATO and Afghanistan for two decades, the Taliban finally took over the country, another blow to the so-called biggest military alliance in the world.
When we made the decision, we all knew the risks. We all knew that entailed risks, also the risk of Taliban returning, though no one anticipated that this should happen so fast, the rapid return of Taliban. But we also knew that the alternative to end our military presence also entailed risks.
NATO's European members did not anticipate that involvement in Afghanistan would be a long war. The European members thought it would be a low-cost demonstration of solidarity and sympathy with American people, rather than a protracted operational commitment. According to one assessment, European politicians declared that Afghanistan was vital to their own security, but in practice continued to treat it as an American responsibility. In the context of a faltering campaign, the upshot was evaporating public support and mutual transatlantic disillusionment. Despite a two-decade occupation, NATO failed to bring peace and security to Afghanistan. A few months ago, the British Defence Secretary Ben Wallace pointed out that NATO was a political failure in Afghanistan. While NATO claims to be promoting peace across the world, the recent case of Ukraine reveals the opposite. By poking Russia through its expansionism, NATO is certainly more than an innocent bystander in the current Ukraine-Russia escalation. Not only has the organization failed in promoting peace, NATO has almost been standing by and doing nothing in the wake of this conflict, a stab in the back for the Ukrainians. In late February, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan accused NATO and the European Union of failing to take a determined stance on the Russian attack on Ukraine. The fact is, NATO's response to Russia's current actions does not mirror its response to Russia during the Cold War. The inaction has prompted Kyiv to reconsider its attempt to join NATO. This hesitation to get directly involved in the Ukraine-Russia conflict comes after a series of defeats NATO suffered in Afghanistan and Libya. It seems that the organization is unable to fulfill even its original mission, i.e., to deter the Russian bear.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zayed Al Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al Uzma Al Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. After talking about halal income and the dangers of not taking care about how we earn our money and how spiritually polluting an impure and illegitimate income would be, there are different kinds of ways of earning money and different types of methods of expenditures and ways of spending. And I think the one important thing for us to always remember that I'm going to be repeating frequently is to remember two important points that we can see that are frequently mentioned in our religion, Islam. Number one is balance. Number two is rida and being happy and content with what you have. Balance, as the Quran says, don't lock your fist, your hand as a fist tight to your neck, and don't be greedy, and don't open your hand all the way, which means don't be careless when it comes to, or reckless when it comes to money issues. Have balance. When it comes to content, when it comes to rida, be happy with what you have. Stop looking over the fence. Stop always comparing yourself to someone who is financially higher than you. In that case, you're always going to be eating yourself from with inside. You're always going to be miserable, you know. And then those other very evil kind of inside, batani, evil traits start to appear. The most dangerous of them is greed. The most dangerous of them is hasad and enviness. And of course, that becomes, you know, the worst of worst when it comes to you as a human being.
Oh. Ayatollah Javadi Amoli, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al-Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
There are many lessons
of the book
by those prophets.
And eat, take some in your hand, and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Another important point is, when it comes to tijara, is to remember that there are ad'iyah, there are supplications that a person should recite at the time of business, at the time of wanting rizq, and things like that. Now, of course, you don't want to be a person, when it does come to affairs of business, as Ayatollah Jawadi Amoli says, you don't want to be that person who always, you know, is lies or deceives or unfaithful or disloyal or deceiving when it comes to business transactions and things like that. When it comes to ribh, when it comes to having profits, be reasonable in the profit that you want to make. You know, don't overdo it. You know, laysa min al-muru'a al-ribh 'ala al-akhwan. You know, it's not chivalry. It's not a chivalrous thing for a person to gain profit from their brethren. A lot of these things that speak about remembering that a person should not dallis, should not deceive, should not have ghish. Man ghasha musliman fi shira'in aw bay'in falaysa minna. If you deceive a fellow Muslim in buying something or in selling something, then you are not considered to be a Muslim. And there's one, two, three full pages that speak about deception and deceiving and being fraudulent in business transactions. And of course, many of these ahadith speak about how evil a person is. If you were to lie, if you were to, you know, deceive, if you were to try to rip someone off, as we usually say.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Now, again, there are certain kind of mu'amalat that a person should, or a certain kind of business transactions that a person should stay away from, that a person should avoid. And that is when it comes to dealing with the case of, for example, we gave the example of dogs. If the dog is not used for hunting, if the dog is not used for as a shepherd, if the dog, then of course, a guarding dog, then of course, such an example of transaction, buying or selling, would of course be classified as halal. There's one hadith, for example, that sometimes there are certain acts that are classified as makruh when it does come to transaction and business and things like that. I think an important point again here that needs to be mentioned is having a skill. And that's the fourth point here that Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli says. To have a skill, to have a hirfa, to have a sana. And whatever that skill may be, as long as it's halal, as long as this skill is halal, then of course we need to continue on in remembering that there's that whole topic of having balance in everything that we need to do. And of course, especially when it comes to the financial side. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Special point regarding Sheikh Abdulmon Az-Zain is that broadened his activities and focused on invitation for local people.
So over there we see that he start to create relationship with the Sunni leaders and make them to get convinced to accept the school of Ahlul Bayt as one of the formal or official denominations of Islam.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So the program, The Teacher, is about the life and the works and the methods of research of the most outstanding Muslim scholars, philosophers, jurists, and thinkers all across the nation of Islam, especially the Shiite ones. And for today's discussion, we want to discuss the life and works of a person who has spent most of his life in the country Senegal, one of the African countries, being busy with spreading Islam over there. He is no one but Abdul Mun'im Zain, the outstanding Lebanese cleric. Okay, Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the education and early life of Abdul Mun'im Zain.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Abdul Mun'im Zain is a Lebanese cleric that was a student of Sayyid Musa al-Sadr. And by suggestion of Imam Musa al-Sadr, he moved from Lebanon to Africa, and especially to the country of Senegal, in the city of Dakar, the capital of the country.
Okay.
You know, at that time, and currently, of course, there were some Lebanese living in Africa. You know, Lebanese are living all around the world.
Yes.
Lebanon is a special country in this case.
Yes.
And the population of Lebanese that are living all around the world are more the population Lebanese that are living in Lebanon itself.
Okay.
So many of them are living in Africa, and some of them are living in the west of Africa. That Senegal also is in the west of Africa.
That's right.
So Sheikh Abdul Mun'im Zain moved from Lebanon to Senegal to stay there and to be a resident scholar and resident sheikh for people and the followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam over there.
Was it by the invitation of Sayyid al-Sadr, Imam Musa al-Sadr, in order to go there, in order to preach Islam or something like
yes.
that?
Yes. Okay. You know, Imam Musa al-Sadr paid a visit to Africa after that he was chosen. Of course, he was the founder of the
yes.
Majlis al-A'la in Lebanon.
Yes.
So after founding that, you know, Congress, he had some visits to some other countries. He paid a visit to Africa, some of the countries that one of them was Senegal.
Yes.
And after returning back to Lebanon, they asked him when he was there, they asked him to send a sheikh for them.
Okay.
That's why he asks Sheikh Abdul Mun'im Zain to go to Senegal to be a resident scholar over there.
Okay.
So, but the special point regarding Sheikh Abdul Mun'im Zain is that he didn't, you know, limit and specialized his activities only for Lebanese. Of course, he was invited by them. He settled in Dakar to preach for Lebanese, first of all.
Yes.
But he broadened his activities and focused on invitation for local people.
That's right.
So that's why, after some years, because he moved to Senegal in 1969.
Yes.
And now it's about 40 years that he is over there. He was a young man.
Maybe 50 years.
Yes, more than 40 years.
Up to 20. Yeah. 50 years, that's right.
It's about 50 years.
Okay.
So after these years, we may find that he has invited more than 100,000 people to the School of Thought of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam, and established many schools over there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to have a way to introduce the School of Thought of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam to people,
yes.
clearly a true follower of this hadith of Imam al-Sadr alayhi salam, that His Holiness says, كُنُوا لَنَا زَيْنًا وَلَا تَكُنُوا لَنَا شَيْنًا. Be glory for us, but not be shame for us.
Okay.
So he tried to broadcast the voice of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam amongst local people,
mm-hmm.
and to be a good role model in this That's regard right. for other sheikhs also.
Especially we know that Africa at that time, 50, 60 years ago, the country Senegal, for sure must not have facilities for life, for example, as it was even in Lebanon at that time, you know, it was, and the population over there might not be familiar with some presuppositions or Islamic background. So it is really, I think, a difficult task for a muballigh to go to a strange land with a strange people, a strange culture, and they step by step invite them into, can I say, the Shiite Islam, up to an extent that they were calling him as the Shiite caliph over there, or the Shiite chief over there. Okay, Sheikh Mahtawi, I think the main mission of such muballigh and scholars is this, in order to spread Islam and we can say familiarize the people of the foreign lands and the far lands with the Shiite Islam. How much do you think Abdul Mun'im Zain was successful in Senegal?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think Sheikh Abdul Mun'im Zain, as our brother mentioned, was a true follower of Ahlul Bayt, and we can call him the alim, or the scholar of the time and space.
Mm-hmm.
Because when he moved to Senegal, he knew that Islam had a very long route in Senegal, because in the west of the Africa, we have many Muslim communities.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not to say it's kind of Central Africa or south of the Africa, which Christianity is a dominating religion over there.
Okay.
But in the west of the Africa, we have Islamic communities growing over there. So he was really understanding the time and the issues of time and space. So we can say, as our brother mentioned, since he went there under the suggestion and recommendation of Sayyid Musa al-Sadr, he followed the same steps that Sayyid Musa al-Sadr or Imam Musa al-Sadr did in Lebanon, okay, in order to bring glory and actually dignity for Shia community in Lebanon, for the Lebanese community. So over there, we see that he start to create relationship with the Sunni leaders, mm-hmm, in terms or under the umbrella of Islam, to put aside all differences and sit around one table, start communicating with them,
right,
and make them to get convinced to accept Shiism or the school of Ahlul Bayt as one of the formal or official denominations of Islam.
That's right.
Because living in Iran or Shia community will make us to judge that Shia or school of Ahlul Bayt must be accepted by all people all around the world.
Yes.
But because of the propaganda against Shia school of thought, some of the Muslims are not going to treat Shias as Muslims,
okay,
because of the propaganda.
Yes.
So he was knowing this issue. Mm-hmm. When he moved to Senegal, first of all, he sat with the leaders of Sunnis, starting to make this Shia school of thought as one of the official denominations.
That's right.
So it is also mentioned in his biography as one of his achievements, mm-hmm, that by his effort, they actually recognized Shia as one of the denominations, the same as those four denominations of Islam that we have.
That's right.
This was one of the steps that he did, and Imam Musa al-Sadr also did in Lebanon. And then after this, he was actually looking at the youth, uh-huh, and kids,
okay,
because he was aware that if anything is going to happen, it will happen based on this potential, which is within the youth and kids. So we see in his biography that more than 120 schools he established.
Oh.
So this is something great.
Hmm.
So to go there,
yes,
start benefiting from the support of your Lebanese brothers,
okay,
among you, because as
yes,
our brother mentioned, Lebanese are good businessmen,
yes,
specifically in Africa. So benefiting from this money,
okay,
and capital in order to spread Shia, but technically and systematically.
Yes. Yes.
And besides school, he established many masajid.
Mm-hmm.
And besides masajid, many Islamic entities,
yes,
or let's say charity entities.
Yes.
As we look at these parts, we see that these are different pillars with which he was actually capable of bringing about Shia community.
That's right.
But why? Because creating a community is not only based on going up the member and start giving and delivering speeches.
That's right.
You have to work on the youth. You have to work on the kids. You have to start communication with the leaders, I mean, mm, other leaders,
yes,
to receive some sort of acceptance,
yes,
in the community.
Okay.
And as we see, he was granted this chance to receive the national medal from the president of Senegal. It shows that how powerfully he was taking his steps in order to create this community.
I think he was directly under the influence of the method of the preaching and tabligh of Imam Musa al-Sadr. This interface, intraface dialogue that Imam Musa al-Sadr was after, and not focusing on the differences between the religions, rather on the commonalities, can obviously be seen in the works of Sheikh Abdul Munim al-Zayn too. That was, he was successful. And politically speaking, most of the African countries, you know, we know that the African lands, because of the situation over there, because they have been monopolized by the arrogant superpowers for so many years, they are, I think, after justice. And they are after, we can say, seeking justice. So when a person under the slogan and banner of Islam which is the slogan of brotherhood, Ukhuwa and Mawadda, comes to their land, they are welcomed very much. And Sheikh Abdul Munim, I think, was successful. And as you said, politically speaking, he could reach the medal, you know, the national medal trophy of the country in 2014 by the president over there. He has also authored some books, you know, he was active authoring some books, presenting in the conferences over there and publishing his works in both English language and the Arabic language, which was his mother tongue. Okay, any other details about his life, Sheikh Zainia?
Maybe this point is also interesting regarding the manner that he was using to invite people to the School of Thought of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wassalatu wassalam. That is, he says that the first step that I took was giving some books to people as a gift. When they started studying these books, after some while, I was talking to them, okay, how did you find this book? And we had some discussions for some hours about the subjects that were discussed in the book. And then after some, you know, discussions, if the person was, you know, agreed, he would recite, he or she would recite Shahadatain.
Yes.
And I would like to mention this, that this is exactly in accordance with the verse of Holy Quran that Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim in Surah An-Nahl. أدعو إلى سبيل ربك بالحكمة والموعظة الحسنة. And Sheikh Abdul Munim Az-Zain is correctly and truly using this manner and method that he is using books, hikmah, والموعظة الحسنة. He talks to people,
giving them advices.
Beautiful. And then lets them think. Okay, if you agree and if you want, you may recite Shahadatain. And then he used to give them certificates regarding this to, you know, we may say authenticate the personality of, you know, Shia people over there. Another important point is that he had good relationship with Sunni brothers in a way that after living some years in Senegal, because now he is he has the nationality of Senegal. And from 1987, he was given this nationality.
Lebanese Senegalese.
Double nationality.
Yes.
So he, you know, interacted with Sunni brothers in a way that the imams of the School of Thought of Ahlul Sunnah, they were there are four imams, Maliki, Hanbali, Shafi'i, and Hanafi.
Yes.
And they called the most prominent scholar in their, you know, School of Thought, they call it Khalifa, Caliph.
Yes.
Sheikh Abdul Munim Az-Zain interacted with them in a way that they accepted him as the fifth caliph. That's why he is called the caliph of Ithna Ashari School of Thought.
Okay. Caliph means the chief or the head of
the chief.
An Islamic sect or denomination. This title was given to him. And this, you know, formal recognition, or the official recognition of the School of Thought of the Ahlul Bayt among our Sunni brethren really show that our Sunni brethren are also welcoming the ideas of the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. They have respect for the Shiite imams. But unfortunately, in today's world, the segregationists and seditionists all around the world try to plant the seed of disagreement and discord among the Muslims. But the works of people like Abdul Munim Zain shows that it is possible that we have peaceful talks with our Sunni brethren in far, far lands, and then the people are free in order to choose their beliefs, whether it be according to the Sunni beliefs or the Shiite beliefs. And Abdul Munim Zain, I think, was the source of benefit for so many people over there. Okay, any other detail? No? Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziaynia and Sheikh Mahtavi, for your presence in the program, The Teacher. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala protect the people and preachers and muballiqin like Abdul Munim Zain, you know, the people who spend their life in far, far lands away from. Believe me, it is very much difficult to leave your homeland, to leave the people with your same language and the culture, you know, and go to a far, far land, living over there, preach Islam. And inshallah, the sawab and the reward of these people is multiplied by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, anywhere they are. Thank you much. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher, which was about the Lebanese scholar Abdul Mun'im Zain, who is spending most of his life in preaching Shia Islam in Senegal in West Africa. For more information, you can visit our website at parstoday.com/Shia and Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
Rules of Engagement Part 2
Berlin, Germany. From here, we are going to start looking at the occupation of Palestine. This is an unusual look through the eyes of Israeli soldiers that broke their silence. They will tell about the crimes they committed on behalf of the Zionist regime.
Now 4 million people control the Palestinian society, and we as soldiers that were sent to the army in Israel at the age of 18, 19, you go to the army, it's a mandatory service. About 5-6 months, I served in Hebron, the second largest Palestinian city in the West Bank. 800 settlers that live inside of a Palestinian city. For those 800 people, there are about 500, 600 security forces to protect them. This exhibition, about 60 pictures all taken by soldiers, and they took those pictures during their military service for a memory for themselves. When your mission is to do a curfew or detain people and you succeed in this mission, you wanna document. This is like a trophy for you. It's a sick trophy, and these guys, no doubt, lost every kind of limit there is. And if that's not enough, you see this soldier here, the officer, he wanted the trophy only for himself. So he wanted to do a Photoshop picture. This is not a genuine picture. This is not real. It's copied here. I did occupation. I controlled people's lives. I decided if someone can or cannot go to school today. This picture is a good example. A soldier randomly checking a Palestinian in the street. The middle of the day, he hasn't done anything. He's not suspected. He checks him. This was probably the most regular view in Hebron for us. Detain Palestinians. Hundreds of them. So what does it mean to detain a person? See the soldiers on the back? This was a good time to relax, to have a break, smoke a cigarette, talk with your friend, watch TV, have a lunch maybe. Without noticing again, these people that you detain, start looking at them as people. They are just detained Palestinians. Blindfolded, always. We see here are confiscated keys, Palestinian keys. We control not only people's cars, we control people's keys, homes and shops and apartments, whatever you can imagine. You can come a bit closer, I want to show you this picture. If you would look carefully, Palestinian kids play soldiers. See, they're checking each other. These are supposed to be the guns. And in a way, I'm saying it in a very sad way, because these children imitate their life. This is not their imagination, what they saw. That they are doing this is because they live under occupation.
To know more about this movement that is rising among the Israeli soldiers, we travel to Israel. Here we are going to meet former soldiers and officers that helped to keep the occupant of Palestine alive. From Tel Aviv, we take the road. Our destination, Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron, Palestine. This route, like 80% of the total highway system in the West Bank, is forbidden to Palestinians. Built on private Palestinian land, these highways bisect through villages, dividing families and boxing Palestinians into enclaves. We want to reach the Al-Khalil city centre. After exposing the Israeli army crimes, Nadav, a former infantry combat soldier, is going to meet us here in the ground zero of the occupation.
My name is Nadav Beagleman. I'm originally from Jerusalem. I served in the IDF, in the 5th Battalion of the Nahal Brigade as an infantry. And I reached here for the first time when I was wearing a uniform and holding a gun when I was in the army. And I was shocked. I was shocked that a reality like this could happen 40 minutes from my house. The settlers here are an issue. Yeah, we're talking about 850 settlers. They're being protected by around 500 to 600 security forces in any given day. So around the settlements, there are areas that Palestinians cannot move to secure the settlers. And there's a lot of violence that comes from the settlers.
Welcome to Al-Khalil. Al-Khalil is the ground zero for the illegal Israeli settler movement, radical Zionism and violence. Radical settlers have taken over parts of Old City. Palestinian neighborhoods and the economy were destroyed. Settlers are free to kill and terrorize Palestinians. Oh. 850 Zionist settlers set down in the Al-Khalil city center. Palestinians were expelled. They now live surrounded by a fence or a cage from where they cannot move. If you want to know what occupation really means, you should come to Al-Khalil. We are a potential target for the Jewish settlers' hate. We have a camera, and our guide is a former soldier that has broken his silence. Traitor, according to the settlers.
This is a picture that was taken in the late 90s in this street that we are on now, and I think this tells the whole story, how hundreds and thousands of people, Palestinians, left here. We're talking about 42% of the housing units of Palestinians around the settlement were abandoned. 1,800 shops of Palestinians were shut down. The shops we see here next to us, part of them. Hundreds were shut down by the army. Hundreds were shut down by the Palestinians.
Al-Khalil is divided into two parts. H1 and H2, drawing a line between the settlements and the rest of the city. Palestinians are not allowed anywhere near H2. Shuhada, the main Al-Khalil street, was once a bustling market and residential neighborhood. Today, Shuhada is a ghost area. Only settlers can cross it. Palestinians are forbidden to approach Shuhada.
This is an important place because, first of all, this used to go back and forth to the markets, the other side. We came from over there, it's basically all shut down. There is nothing, everything is shut down. Most of the families left, except one family. That family was able, up until a few years ago, to walk through here as well. Now that it's sealed, they also need to go all the way from around. Another gate here that the soldiers needs to open. But this is just one, you know, very small example of how shutting down of roads to Palestinian movement.
August 2016. Israeli soldiers are entering Palestinian houses in Al-Khalil. An activist follows them with a camera.
Can you tell me why you're entering Palestinian houses?
We are doing our job.
Okay, good job. What exactly are you trying to achieve? Because these are people, they live here, right? It's not your homes.
This time, the Israeli army steps back. Soldiers don't want witnesses. Reach Al-Khalil's main square, a forbidden territory for the Palestinians. What we're about to see is part of the occupation daily routine. A 15-year-old Palestinian girl is arrested in a checkpoint. She is taken inside a police station and disappears for some time.
she is accused of trying to stab a soldier. When she is taken outside, her hands are tied and she is heavily guarded by soldiers and police. She is left under the sun for hours, and this is what happens next. For this Palestinian teenager, this is just the beginning of a long nightmare. An Israeli police officer takes photos of the girl in the middle of the street, in front of everybody. Finally, she is taken away. She will be taken to a military base, will face a military court, and will end in a military jail.